A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and honestly, I think he's speaking for a lot of people. He wants to understand the basic anatomy of a building, the stuff behind the drywall, because he's realizing that knowing how a wall is actually put together matters the moment you pick up a drill. He mentioned our conduits episode where wall studs came up and admitted he only vaguely knows what a stud is, something you probe for. So the question is, what should anyone who might drill into a wall, or just wants to understand what's going on beyond the paint in the roof, actually know? And here we are.
Here we are. And this is one of those topics where the gap between what people think they know and what's actually going on is enormous. Most people walk through a house and see walls and ceilings as these monolithic surfaces. In reality, a house is a carefully engineered skeleton wrapped in thin sheets, with systems running through the cavities like veins and arteries. It's genuinely elegant.
The donkey's calling 2x4s elegant.
Platform framing, which is how the vast majority of North American homes have been built since about the 1950s, is this beautifully simple, repetitive system, and the stud is the fundamental unit. So let's start there, because if you don't understand the stud, nothing else makes sense.
What is a wall stud? For the person who's been nodding along at dinner parties.
A wall stud is a vertical framing member, almost always 2x4 or 2x6 lumber in residential construction, that runs from the bottom plate to the top plate of a wall. The bottom plate is a horizontal piece anchored to the floor system. The top plate is a double layer of horizontal lumber at the ceiling line. The studs are spaced at regular intervals between them, typically 16 inches on center in the United States, though 24-inch spacing is allowed in some cases.
16 inches on center. What does on center mean?
It means you measure from the center of one stud to the center of the next. So if you find one stud, the next one is exactly 16 inches away at its midpoint. This matters enormously when you're mounting something heavy. If you anchor a television mount or a shelf into just drywall, it'll tear out. Possibly immediately, possibly when you least expect it. You need to hit the stud. That's why stud finders exist.
The device that, in every household I've ever visited, gets waved around by someone who then says, "I think this thing is broken," while it beeps at their own hand.
The classic joke. But the underlying point is serious. Drywall, also called gypsum board or sheetrock, is typically half an inch thick. It's basically compressed gypsum plaster between two layers of paper. It has almost no structural strength in tension or shear. It'll hold a picture hook with a small nail. It will not hold a shelf with books or a wall-mounted sink or anything that generates meaningful leverage.
The stud is what you're actually anchoring to. The drywall is just the skin.
And this is the first thing every DIYer needs to internalize. Before you drill, you need to know what you're drilling into. Is it drywall over a stud? Is it drywall over an empty cavity? Is it something else entirely, like a metal stud or a plumbing vent or a wire?
If you drill into a wire, the consequences are not subtle.
They range from tripping a breaker to a very bad afternoon involving an electrician and a hole in your wall. But let's stay with wood studs for a moment, because they're the norm. A typical 2x4 is actually 1.5 inches by 3.5 inches. The naming is nominal. It refers to the rough sawn dimensions before drying and planing. So when you're drilling into the edge of a stud, you've got 1.5 inches of wood to work with. That's not a lot of margin for error. If your screw is off center by 3/4 of an inch, you're into the drywall cavity.
Which brings us to the probing. The thing Daniel mentioned, you probe to figure out where the edges of the stud are, not just the center.
A stud finder will tell you the approximate center, but if you're mounting something critical, you want to verify. The old school method is to drill a tiny pilot hole and feel for resistance. If you hit wood, you're on the stud. If the bit punches through after 1/2 inch of resistance, you just found drywall and nothing else. The more sophisticated approach is to probe with a thin finish nail or a dedicated awl. Find the edges, mark them, and split the difference.
This is already more involved than most people imagine when they pull a shelf bracket out of the box.
We haven't even talked about what's inside those wall cavities. Because studs aren't just structural, they create the space where everything else lives. Electrical wiring, plumbing supply and drain lines, HVAC ducts, insulation, low voltage cables. All of it runs through the spaces between studs, joists, and rafters.
Let's talk about those next. Joists, rafters, the horizontal cousins of the stud.
Joists are the horizontal framing members that support floors and ceilings. In a typical house, you've got floor joists, usually 2x8, 2x10, or 2x12 lumber, or increasingly engineered I-joists, spanning between foundation walls or beams. On top of those joists sits the subfloor, typically 3/4-inch tongue-and-groove plywood or oriented strand board. Then your finished flooring goes on top of that.
When you're walking across your living room, you're actually walking on a thin finish layer, on top of a plywood sheet, on top of horizontal beams that are themselves supported by walls or beams below. It's layers all the way down.
Layers all the way down is exactly right. And understanding those layers matters when you're doing anything that penetrates the floor, like running a new heating vent, or drilling for cable routing, or even just dealing with a squeak. Squeaky floors are usually the result of the subfloor rubbing against a joist because a fastener has loosened.
The house is talking to you. It's saying, I'm not as rigid as you thought.
And ceiling joists are the same principle, just inverted. They support the ceiling drywall from above, and in many cases they also serve as the bottom cord of the roof truss system. In a two-story house, the ceiling joists of the first floor are also the floor joists of the second floor. It's an elegant stacking system.
Those are the angled ones in the attic.
Rafters are the traditional way to frame a roof, pairs of angled members that meet at a ridge board at the peak. Each rafter is notched at the bottom to sit on the top plate of the exterior wall, a detail called a bird's mouth cut. The rafters carry the weight of the roof sheathing, underlayment, and shingles or tiles down to the walls.
You said traditional. There's a newer way.
Prefabricated triangular assemblies, usually made of 2x4 lumber connected by metal connector plates, those toothed plates you see pressed into the joints. Trusses are engineered to span the entire width of the house in one piece, and they're lifted into place by crane. They're faster to install, they use less lumber, and they can clear span larger distances without interior load-bearing walls. Most production homes built since the 1980s use trusses rather than stick-framed rafters.
If you're up in your attic and you see those metal plates with teeth pressed into the wood at every joint, you're looking at trusses. Don't mess with those.
Absolutely do not mess with trusses. They're engineered as a system. Cutting or modifying a single member can compromise the entire assembly. There was a case I read about where a homeowner wanted to create attic storage and cut through several truss bottom cords to make space. The roof sagged within weeks. The repair cost more than the original roof.
That's the I saw it on YouTube School of Structural Engineering,
which has a surprisingly high failure rate. But let's step back to walls, because there's another component that the prompt is really asking about, the layers. A wall isn't just studs and drywall. From the outside in, a typical exterior wall in a modern house goes siding, house wrap or building paper, sheathing, usually plywood or oriented strand board. Then the stud cavity with insulation, then a vapor barrier in cold climates, then drywall. That's 6 or 7 layers, each with a specific job.
The building is onion. Let's go through those layers.
Siding is the outermost layer, the aesthetic face, and the first line of defense against weather. Vinyl, fiber cement, wood, brick veneer, stucco. Behind the siding is the weather-resistive barrier, house wrap like Tyvek, or traditional asphalt-saturated felt paper. Its job is to shed liquid water that gets past the siding while allowing water vapor to escape from inside the wall cavity.
It breathes in one direction. Water out, not water in.
Behind that is the sheathing. Structural panels, usually 4x8 feet, nailed to the studs. Sheathing provides racking resistance, which is the wall's ability to resist being pushed over sideways by wind or seismic forces. Without sheathing, a stud wall is basically a parallelogram waiting to happen.
Parallelogram waiting to happen. That's the name of my next album.
I'd buy it. Inside the stud cavity goes insulation. Fiberglass bats, mineral wool, spray foam, or blown-in cellulose. Then, in heating-dominated climates where the indoor air is more humid than outdoor air for much of the year, a vapor retarder goes on the warm side of the wall, which is the interior side in cold climates. This prevents moisture from condensing inside the wall cavity, which leads to rot and mold.
The order of these layers matters. You can't just put the vapor barrier wherever.
The order is critical, and it changes depending on climate. In a hot, humid climate like Florida or Singapore, the vapor barrier goes on the exterior side of the assembly because the dominant moisture drive is from outside to inside. Put it on the wrong side, and you've created a moisture trap. Walls rot from the inside out, and you don't know it's happening until the paint starts bubbling or the baseboard crumbles.
The same wall built in Minnesota and Miami would have a different layer sequence.
Builders who ignore this are gambling with their clients' money. And the problem is, moisture damage takes years to become visible. By the time you see it, the framing is already compromised.
Interior walls, the ones between rooms. Simpler stack, I assume.
Studs, drywall on both sides, and that's basically it for a non-load-bearing partition wall. Sometimes you'll add fiberglass insulation for sound control. It's surprisingly effective at dampening noise transmission between rooms. But there's no sheathing, no house wrap, no weather barrier. An interior wall is just a frame with a skin.
Which means if you're drilling into an interior wall to hang something, you've got a cavity on the other side of the drywall. If you miss the stud, there's nothing behind it but air and maybe some insulation.
Or a wire, or a pipe. Never assume an interior wall cavity is empty. Bathroom walls contain plumbing vent stacks and supply lines. Walls near electrical panels are dense with wiring. Kitchen walls hide gas lines and drain pipes. The golden rule of drilling into walls: know what's on the other side and know what's inside.
This feels like the right moment to talk about load paths, because that's the thing people really don't think about. They look at a wall and think wall. They don't think this wall is holding up the floor above it, which is holding up the wall above that, which is holding up the roof.
Load path is the single most important concept in structural engineering for residential construction, and it's completely invisible once the drywall is up. The idea is that every pound of weight in the building, the dead load of the materials, the live load of furniture and people, the environmental load of snow and wind, has to travel through the structure down to the foundation and into the ground. It follows a continuous path. Interrupt that path, and things fail.
The most common way a DIYer interrupts that path is by cutting into a load-bearing wall.
A load-bearing wall is any wall that supports weight from above: floors, ceilings, roofs, other walls. In platform framing, load-bearing walls typically stack directly on top of each other from floor to floor. If you remove a section of a load-bearing wall without properly transferring the load, usually by installing a header beam supported by jack studs and king studs on either side, the structure above will sag or collapse.
Header, jack stud, king stud.
A header is a horizontal beam, usually two 2x10s or 2x12s, sandwiched together with a plywood spacer that spans an opening in a load-bearing wall, like a doorway or a window. The header carries the load from above and transfers it to the jack studs, which are shorter vertical studs directly under each end of the header. The king studs are full-height studs that run alongside the jack studs from bottom plate to top plate, providing lateral stability.
If you're looking at a doorway, the header is the beam across the top, the jack studs are the short ones supporting the header, and the king studs are the tall ones bookending the whole assembly.
And this is why you can't just knock a hole in a wall and call it a pass-through. If it's load-bearing, you need a header size to the span and the load. The wider the opening, the deeper the header needs to be. Building codes specify minimum header sizes based on span, snow load, and the number of floors supported.
Which brings us to the building permit, the thing nobody wants to deal with, but everyone should.
Building permits exist because structures fail in predictable ways when people skip the engineering. A permit means someone, a building inspector, will verify that the work meets minimum safety standards. It's not bureaucratic red tape. It's the institutional memory of every collapsed deck, every electrical fire, every gas leak that taught us what not to do.
Yet the instinct is, it's my house, I'll do what I want.
The instinct is powerful and wrong. I've seen homeowners open up walls and find spliced wiring wrapped in electrical tape, buried junction boxes, notched joists that have lost 60% of their load capacity. All of it done by previous owners who were confident they knew what they were doing.
The previous owner was a real craftsman. The most terrifying sentence in home improvement.
It truly is. All right, let's get into the systems that run through the framing, because the prompt specifically asked about what's inside the walls. Electrical first, because it's the most likely thing you'll encounter when drilling.
The most likely to ruin your day if you hit it.
Residential electrical wiring in North America is predominantly non-metallic sheathed cable. Romex is the brand name everyone uses generically. It consists of two or more insulated conductors and a bare ground wire, all wrapped in a plastic jacket. The cable runs through holes drilled in the center of studs and joists, and it's secured with staples within a certain distance of each box.
Why the center of the stud?
Because drywall screws are typically 1 1/4 to 1 5/8 inches long. If the wire is in the center of a 3.5-inch stud, there's roughly 1 1/4 inches of wood between the wire and the face of the drywall. A drywall screw won't reach it. But if the wire is running along the side of the stud, or if someone notched the stud to run the wire and didn't install a nail plate, a screw or a drill bit can hit it easily.
That's the metal shield you sometimes see on studs in renovation photos.
A nail plate is a small steel plate, maybe 1.5 inches by 3 inches, nailed to the face of a stud where a wire or pipe passes through. It's specifically designed to stop a drywall screw or a drill bit from penetrating. Code requires them wherever the edge of a hole is less than 1 1/4 inches from the face of the stud. If you're drilling into a stud and you hit metal, stop. You've probably found a nail plate, and there's something behind it you don't want to damage.
That's the kind of detail that separates. I watched a tutorial from I understand what I'm doing.
It's exactly the level of knowledge the prompt is asking for. Let's talk about plumbing, because water in walls is a whole different category of concern.
Water and electricity. What could go wrong?
Plumbing in walls consists of supply lines, pressurized hot and cold water, and drain waste vent lines, which are not pressurized and rely on gravity. Supply lines are typically copper, PEX, or CPVC. PEX has become dominant in the last 20 years because it's flexible, freeze-resistant, and much faster to install than soldered copper. It comes in red and blue to distinguish hot and cold.
If you drill into a PEX line,
you'll know immediately. Pressurized water sprays out. If you're lucky, you can shut off the water at the nearest valve before significant damage. If you're not lucky, you're replacing drywall and flooring. But the real nightmare is hitting a drain line. Drain lines are larger, typically 1.5 to 4 inches in diameter, usually ABS or PVC plastic, and they carry wastewater. If you put a screw through a drain pipe, you might not notice immediately. It's not under pressure. But over time, every time someone runs the sink or flushes the toilet, a small amount of water seeps out. By the time you see the stain on the ceiling below, the damage inside the wall is extensive.
The lesson is, know what's behind the drywall before you penetrate it. But how do you actually know?
First, context clues. What room are you in, and what's on the other side of this wall? If there's a bathroom on the other side, assume plumbing. If there's a light switch or an outlet on this wall, assume wiring runs vertically from that box to the attic or the basement. Second, you can use a more sophisticated stud finder that includes electrical detection. It'll beep when it senses live AC voltage behind the drywall. Third, you can cut a small inspection hole and look inside with a flashlight and an inspection camera. Those USB endoscope cameras cost about $30 and they've saved people thousands.
$30 versus thousands in repairs. That's a compelling argument.
The economics of home improvement are brutal. The materials are cheap relative to the labor of fixing mistakes. A tube of silicone caulk is $8. Replacing a water-damaged window frame is thousands. The difference is knowing where the caulk goes and why.
Let's talk about foundations, because everything we've discussed so far is sitting on one.
The foundation is where the load path terminates. The most common types in North American residential construction are poured concrete walls, concrete block walls, and slab-on-grade. Poured concrete foundations are continuous walls, typically 8 to 10 inches thick, extending from a concrete footing below the frost line up to the sill plate where the wood framing begins.
That's the depth at which the ground freezes in winter.
In Minnesota, the frost line is 4 to 5 feet deep. In Florida, it's essentially zero. The footing has to sit below the frost line because water-saturated soil expands when it freezes. That's frost heave. And if the footing is in the zone of freezing soil, it'll lift unevenly, cracking the foundation. This is not a theoretical concern. It's why building codes specify minimum footing depths by climate zone.
A house in Minneapolis and a house in Orlando are different all the way down to the bottom of the hole.
And slab-on-grade is a different approach entirely. A single pour of concrete that serves as both foundation and ground floor, typically 4 to 6 inches thick with thickened edges and integral footings. common in warm climates and increasingly used everywhere for cost reasons. But slabs come with their own considerations for DIY work. If you want to move a drain or add a bathroom in a slab-on-grade house, you're cutting concrete. That's not a weekend project.
The slab is the floor. There's no crawl space, no basement. What you see is what you get, and what you get is very hard to modify.
Which is why you see so many slab houses with plumbing concentrated in a few wet walls. The drains are cast into the concrete. Moving them means jackhammering.
All right, we've covered studs, joists, rafters, trusses, wall layers, load paths, headers, electrical, plumbing, and foundations. What about the roof itself, the part that keeps the rain out?
A roof is a system, not a single layer. From the outside in, shingles or roofing material, underlayment, usually synthetic or asphalt-saturated felt, roof sheathing, which is plywood or oriented strand board nailed to the rafters or trusses. Below that is the attic space, with insulation at the ceiling level. And critically, ventilation. A properly vented attic has intake vents at the soffits, the underside of the eave overhang, and exhaust vents at or near the ridge. This creates a convection current. Cool air enters at the bottom, warms up, rises, and exits at the top.
This matters because...
1. In winter, warm, moist air from the living space leaks into the attic and can condense on the underside of the cold roof sheathing, leading to rot and mold. Ventilation removes that moisture. 2. In summer, an unvented attic can reach 150 degrees Fahrenheit, which radiates heat down into the living space and dramatically increases cooling costs. Ventilation keeps the attic closer to outdoor ambient temperature.
The roof is a breathing system. It's not sealed shut.
It's actively managed airflow. And this is one of those things that goes wrong constantly because homeowners or contractors block soffit vents with insulation, or install a ridge vent without adequate intake area, or, in the worst case, install spray foam directly against the underside of the roof, sheathing without understanding the implications for the roofing material's temperature and lifespan.
Every system we've discussed has a failure mode that involves moisture and rot. I'm sensing a theme.
Water is the enemy of wood frame construction. Every building science problem ultimately comes back to water in the wrong place. Bulk water intrusion from leaks. Capillary action wicking water up from the ground. Air-transported moisture condensing inside walls, vapor diffusion through materials. The entire discipline of building science is essentially about managing these four moisture transport mechanisms.
When you're drilling into a wall to mount something, you're also potentially creating a moisture path, a hole through the vapor barrier, a penetration through the house wrap.
For interior walls, it barely matters. For exterior walls, it matters a lot. If you're mounting something like an exterior light fixture or a hose reel on an outside wall, you need to seal the penetration. Caulk around the mounting bracket, use gasketed electrical boxes, flash the top of the fixture so water runs off rather than in. These are small details with large consequences. The rot around a poorly flashed exterior fixture can spread several feet into the wall sheathing before it's visible from outside.
This is the kind of knowledge that makes you look at every house differently. You start seeing the systems. The wall isn't a wall. It's a carefully sequenced assembly of materials, each doing a specific job, and any penetration is a potential failure point.
That's exactly the conceptual understanding the prompt is asking for. It's not about becoming a contractor. It's about developing enough structural literacy to know when you're in over your head and to do the simple things correctly.
Let's talk about tools for a moment. If someone wants to do basic wall penetration, mounting shelves, hanging a television, installing a grab bar, what should they actually own?
A good stud finder with electrical detection. A 4-foot level, the little torpedo levels are fine for quick checks, but for anything mounted, you want a 4-footer. A set of drill bits, including spade bits or auger bits for going through studs if you're running wire. An inspection camera, as I mentioned. A non-contact voltage tester, it looks like a pen, you hold it near a wire or outlet and it lights up if there's voltage present. That's a $15 tool that can prevent a serious shock.
A good drill. People buy cheap drills and wonder why everything is harder than it should be.
A cordless drill with a brushless motor and an impact driver. Two separate tools will cover almost everything a homeowner needs. The drill drives screws and drills holes. The impact driver handles high-torque applications like driving lag screws into studs for a television mount. You can get a decent combo kit for $150 to $200.
When you can't hit a stud, you need anchors. But there are about 400 kinds.
The anchor aisle at the hardware store is the retail embodiment of decision paralysis. But for most DIY applications, you need to know about three types. Toggle bolts for heavy loads and drywall. Only situations. They have spring-loaded wings that open behind the drywall and spread the load across a much larger area. Molly bolts for medium loads. They expand behind the drywall as you tighten. And plastic expansion anchors for light loads like small shelves or curtain rods. The weight rating is on the package. Read it and believe it.
Read it and believe it. The motto of people who've learned the hard way.
Every anchor package has a maximum weight rating, and that rating assumes proper installation, which means the right drill bit size, the right hole depth, and the anchor fully engaged. Miss any of those, and the actual capacity is much lower.
What about drilling into masonry? Brick, concrete, block?
Different animal entirely. You need a hammer drill, which adds a percussive hammer in action to the rotation, and masonry bits, which have carbide tips. A standard drill with a masonry bit will take forever and burn out the bit. A hammer drill goes through concrete like a regular drill goes through wood. And for fastening in the masonry, you use either expansion anchors, wedge anchors, sleeve anchors, or tapcon screws, which are hardened, screws that cut their own threads into a properly sized pilot hole in concrete.
The blue screws?
The blue screws. They're coated for corrosion resistance. And the pilot hole size is absolutely critical. Too small and the screw will snap. Too large and it won't hold. The package tells you exactly which bit to use. This is another read it and believe it situation.
I'm noticing a pattern in your advice. It's basically read the package, use the right tool, and understand what's behind the surface before you penetrate it.
That's the entire discipline of DIY in three rules. Everything else is details, but the details matter enormously. Let's talk about one more thing. The prop touches on obliquely, understanding what's happening beyond the walls and the roof. The house as a system.
The house as a system, not just a collection of parts.
This is the concept of the building enclosure or building envelope, the physical separator between the conditioned interior and the unconditioned exterior. It includes the walls, roof, foundation, windows, and doors. And it has to manage four things simultaneously: heat flow, airflow, moisture flow, and structural loads. Change one thing and you affect the others.
Give me an example.
Someone installs new energy-efficient windows but doesn't address the wall insulation. Now the walls are the coldest surface in the room, and condensation forms on the interior drywall in winter because the dew point has shifted. The window solved one problem and created another. Or someone adds attic insulation but blocks the soffit vents in the process. Now the attic doesn't ventilate, moisture builds up, and the roof sheathing rots. The house is an interconnected system. You can't optimize one component in isolation.
This is why the building science people talk about the house as a system approach. It's not just jargon.
It's the only way to avoid creating new problems while solving old ones. And this is where the DIYer needs humility. If you're doing something that changes the thermal or moisture characteristics of the building enclosure, adding insulation, changing windows, finishing a basement, adding a bathroom fan, you need to understand the knock-on effect. If you don't, hire someone who does.
The most adult sentence you've said all episode is, hire someone who does.
Knowing the limits of your knowledge is a life skill that applies far beyond construction.
Let's bring this back to the practical. Someone's standing in their living room with a drill in one hand and a shelf bracket in the other. What's the checklist?
First, figure out what you're drilling into. Is there a stud where you need it? Second, check for hazards. What's on the other side of this wall? Any plumbing fixtures nearby? Third, choose your fastener. If you're in a stud, a structural screw, like a GRK or a SPAX, is ideal. If you're between studs, choose an anchor rated for your load and wall type. Fourth, drill the right size hole. Fifth, drive the fastener. Sixth, test the connection. Pull on it. If it moves, fix it before you load it.
None of them complicated, but skip one and you're patching drywall.
And that's really the answer to the prompt. The basics everyone should know aren't a list of definitions. Though you should know what a stud, a joist, a header, and a load-bearing wall are, the real basics are the principles. Understand the layers. Know what's inside before you penetrate. Respect the load path. Use the right fastener for the substrate. And when you're not sure, stop and learn before you proceed.
The house is a system, and you're operating on it. The fact that it's a familiar system doesn't make it less complex.
A house is probably the most complex consumer product most people will ever own, and we interact with it primarily through the thin cosmetic layer. It's easy to forget that behind the paint is an engineered assembly doing real work, holding up tons of material, channeling water and electricity and conditioned air, resisting wind and gravity and time. Understanding even a little of how that assembly works is empowering.
It makes you a better neighbor, because you're less likely to flood the shared wall.
All right, before we wrap, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the late 1600s, a Dutch naturalist named Jean van Riebeek documented a species of sea snake near the Solomon Islands, whose venom, according to his shipboard manuscript, could supposedly curdle a man's blood inside his veins within the span of a single tide cycle, though his own notes express skepticism that this was more sailor superstition than medical fact.
Curdle a man's blood? That's vivid.
Jan van Riebeek had a way with words and apparently a low opinion of sailors' credibility. The question the prompt leaves us with, and I think it's the right question, is what happens when everyone knows this stuff? What changes when basic structural literacy is as common as knowing how to change a tire?
Fewer holes in the wrong places, fewer surprised electricians, and a lot more respect for the people who build these things in the first place.
This has been My Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review. It helps other people find the show. Find everything at My Weird Prompts.
I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll be back.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.